I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Even if you are a political junkie, you may not be aware that there's a race for attorney general in Pennsylvania. Former AG Kathleen Kane was just sentenced to 10 to 23 months for perjury, obstruction of justice, and other offenses, so it's an open seat. The next AG will have a lot on their plate besides prosecuting public corruption, consumer fraud, and drug rings, restoring integrity and confidence in the attorney general's office. On Monday, the Democratic candidate Josh Shapiro was our guest, and today we're joined by the Republican candidate John Rafferty. He was deputy attorney general from 1988 to 1991 in the criminal law division prosecuting Medicaid fraud. Since 2003, he served in the state Senate representing parts of Berks, Chester, and Montgomery counties. That's the 44th senatorial district. He's chair of the Senate Transportation Committee, vice chair of the Judiciary Committee, on the Law and Justice Committee, Consumer Protection as well. And John Rafferty, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. My honor.
To our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Any questions for our guest, John Rafferty? I'll begin with you where I began with Josh Shapiro, having to do with the Office of Attorney General after Kathleen Kane's sentencing last month. What can be done to restore integrity?
For the employees, once I'm elected Attorney General, having spent time there in the Office of Attorney General and understanding the operations, that right there will be a morale booster and start to once again instill that professional responsibility in the office. Plus the fact that on our website we already have an ethics policy, a proper use of government property. Like computers, exactly. And we will have job descriptions, and we'll have policies for all the employees to follow. We'll have professional responsibility classes, continuing legal education classes, and we're going to make sure that they understand, the employees there understand, the significance of the role they're playing for the people of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And I'll take the time in the beginning to travel around to all 20 regional offices to make sure that they understand the team concept and what's expected of them. And Marty, I'm one of those type of individuals. I don't stay behind a desk. I will continue to travel throughout the Commonwealth, visiting those regional offices during my time in office. And then for the public, coming into that situation where for 14 years in the Senate, I've been one who's been very frank, oftentimes differed with my caucus, and not afraid to take on a governor, not afraid to take on my caucus. And I've always been a man who means what he says. And that reputation, going over to that office, they know I'm a person of integrity, and I have that keen drive for professional responsibility in the office, I can once again restore the confidence in the Office of Attorney General.
If you found someone, though, using a computer to send racist or pornographic emails or homophobic, sexist emails, would that be a firing offense if you're Attorney General?
Yes. Yes, it would be.
Absolutely?
Yes. If they're sending it, yes. If sometimes they receive it and goes in the spam box, I'll have to review that. But if they are sending it, yes.
I should ask you about a special prosecutor, actually Doug Gansler, is still going through a lot of these emails. Josh Shapiro earlier this week said those emails should all be released. I mean, once you make sure that there's some degree of privacy, but other than that, those emails should be released. How about from you?
Well, I think that shows some lack of experience. As a former prosecutor, you have to go through the files to make sure you aren't releasing information that may be grand jury information, privileged information. It might be containing the names of undercover informants, and if those names get out, you're liable to blow the cover and thwart some cases. So you have to be very careful going through that. Plus the fact that I don't know how this gentleman came up with his review.
This is Doug Gansler.
Doug Gansler. I don't know if he put words into a computer and said any kind of emails that contain these words are then going to be flagged as something pornographic. What concerns me with that, Marty, is what I've heard, and I've heard this, and so is the press corps up in Harrisburg, that there is one set of emails where a lady in government had sent email reminders to other people saying, don't forget this weekend's the Breast Cancer Coalition Walk, and that was flagged because it had the word breast. You have to be very careful. You don't put people's names out there, and they're thinking, oh, you're sending those kinds of information. So I would want to do a thorough review. Other than that, then yes, the emails would be released to the public.
Kathleen Kane said that she stumbled upon an old boys club in Harrisburg. Is there an old boys club from your perspective?
I don't think so. I believe that from what I've read from the press, her sister seemed to have been involved in the pornographic emails, and there's even a rumor that she may have gotten some. So I think it's just part of that network of all these lawyers knew one another, whether they – when they were all practicing lawyers, whether they went on to the attorney general's office or defense counsel or the judges, we have to now instill in them the realization that they are held to a higher standard and you can't treat people that way. You can't be carrying on with jokes. You can't be carrying on with those type of messages.
Does Pennsylvania have a problem of public corruption? I'm thinking about the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, traffic court here in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Parking Authority. I mean, you can make a list of organizations and individuals who've gotten into hot water.
Certainly, I think we do have a problem here in Commonwealth. And we will have – there was a very effective public corruption unit under former Attorney General Tom Corbett, as we saw. And then that kind of fell by the wayside when the Office of Attorney General turned more to defending the Attorney General. But we're going to bring that office back and beef it up. And by the way, Marty, we're going to look at all branches of government. We're going to look at all levels of government in that public corruption unit. I do believe that there's people we have to look at within the executive branch. And I'm not talking necessarily about secretaries or the governor, but people within the executive branch. You have to look at the legislative branch. You have to look at judiciary. And we have to look at county governments and local governments to see – to make sure that they are being stewards of the public trust and public dollars.
Do you have enough staff to do that?
I believe we will have enough staff to do that because we'll become much more effective and efficient in dealing with the other agencies involved and working with the DA's office as well to see what we can do to end corruption within the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
You got an A from the NRA. Did they get an A from you?
I got an A from the NRA. I'm not their spokesperson. Certainly on some of the issues, I'm an advocate for the Second Amendment. I always have been. I think people that can lawfully and legally own guns should be able to lawfully and legally own guns. May I agree with all their policies? No, I don't agree with policies of my own caucus. They did give me that rating and $1,000.
And $1,000. Yeah. And you wear it proudly?
Wear what proudly?
The endorsement?
Sure. My opponent got $250,000 from a New York State billionaire who wants to determine –
Bloomberg.
Who wants to determine who's in the Pennsylvania State Attorney General's office? I don't think so. So my rating affects voters in Pennsylvania that may or may not belong to the NRA, may or may not – adhere to the NRA's policy and politics, but they can make that decision.
Do you think that if someone has a gun that's either lost or stolen, that that should be reported?
I would report my car if I went outside and it wasn't in my driveway.
So same for guns?
Now, what you have to be careful of in the wording of that legislation, that's what we've always wrestled on in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. There are people that have collections of guns. And they may not know within 24 hours that a gun's missing, So you have to look at all those factual circumstances. You don't want somebody that lawfully and legally owns a gun being criminalized or penalized for something like that. But John Rafferty, personally, like I said, if I go out in the driveway, my car's missing, or I come home and something's missing, I'm calling the police.
How about the reciprocity with other states? Should that be retained or ended?
No, I think that should be retained.
Why?
Because I believe that the legislature wants it that way. The attorney general doesn't make that decision. The legislature makes that decision, and the legislature wants it that way. And with the other states that have reciprocity, then I think we join with them.
Even if their laws are looser, more lax than Pennsylvania laws?
Again, the General Assembly has wanted the reciprocity, and we enforce the laws of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania on those issues.
Let me get Marianne from – looks like Coopersburg, because I know she's got a question about guns. And Marianne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Hi, Mr. Rafferty.
Hi.
I appreciate you taking the time. I read recently that you actually skipped the Senate's latest vote on a law that would give the NRA special legal standing to allow them to sue Pennsylvania cities and towns over their gun laws. I know that you supported this measure in the past, so – I'm wondering why this time you avoided voting on such an important issue.
I didn't avoid.
Sure. I had another part to the question. I'm also curious, as a fiscal conservative, how you explain your support for a bill that has potential to cost our municipalities millions and millions of dollars.
Fair enough. Marianne, thanks for the – go ahead, John.
Thanks, Marianne. I have voted for that bill in the past. I would have voted for the bill that night. I had to take personal leave, and I do – when I'm not on the floor, I do not allow my leadership to vote for me. That's always been one of the problems in Harrisburg. So I did the right thing. I followed the rules of the Senate, and I was not there. However, I know my opponent's trying to make political hay out of it. I've already voted for it. If he would have done his research and anybody else, I'm a co-sponsor on that bill. So it's pretty obvious as to where I am on that bill. And had I been able to be on the floor, I would have voted for that bill. I believe all the laws of the Commonwealth in that regard should be uniform in that if someone lawfully and legally owns a gun and they live in one of the other counties of Pennsylvania and they travel into another one, that they should know that the laws are the same in that particular county. And that's all I've effectively seen that bill to do and want that bill to do as it goes forward. I know past the House, and I don't know if the governor's done anything on it yet.
I don't think so.
Yeah, yeah.
But the argument is, of course, in places like Philadelphia and some other cities in Pennsylvania that have a serious problem of gun violence, they want to be able to have laws that are more tailored to the problem that they have within their borders.
Marty, I'm going to point to the state of Illinois. Some of the strictest gun laws in this country are in the state of Illinois. What's the murder capital of the country today? Chicago. The bad guys get the guns, which is one of the reasons why I have been and continue to be and will be as Attorney General an advocate for the Gun Violence Task Force that we saw in the city work very effectively as a Democrat district attorney and a Republican AG, where the resources were being spent, the intel was gathered, and the local authorities and the state authorities were going in and getting the illegal guns out of the city of Philadelphia. To this day, people still laud that progress that was made. Under the Kathleen Kane era in the AG's office, that all went by the wayside. The money was still going over for the funding, but it wasn't being utilized properly. I've already talked to my leadership about increasing the funding so it's available not only for the cities of the first class, Philadelphia, but for these cities of the second class, Pittsburgh, and cities of the third class we know are struggling into those issues as well. Reading, Scranton, Harrisburg, all those areas, to make that money available, to have the intel available to go after those illegal guns. Additionally, I was the—
Does that include things like straw purchasers?
Or yeah, well, I'm getting to that one next, too. Yep. Additionally, I was it was a House bill. It was the Brad Fox bill. And for the listeners, Brad Fox was a Plymouth Township police officer who was murdered while on duty by a creep who should have never had a gun in his possession. What had happened was his friend, who could legally buy a gun, went and bought the gun and then gave it to this guy who killed Brad Fox. And we did – the House passed what became the Brad Fox Law, that piece of legislation which made it illegal for straw purchasers and facing heavy jail time if you're a straw purchaser of a gun. And when it got into the Senate, it was a little bit delayed. I took the lead on it in the Senate. We got it through the Senate and got it to the governor for his signature. So that includes straw purchasers. Where we're seeing too, Marty, if I could, with the drug situation now, using as barter, where people were going to legally – who can legally buy guns or buying them – and trading them to the dealers who cannot legally purchase a gun or own a gun and getting drugs for it. So the Brad Fox Law combined with the Gun Violence Task Force will do a great deal to go after those type of individuals.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Republican candidate for Attorney General here in Pennsylvania, John Rafferty, telling us why he wants the job. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. A bunch of comments, radiotimes at whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne talking with Senator John Rafferty of Pennsylvania, wants to be the next attorney general. And again, calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You wanted to add something about the
floor vote. Yeah,
the floor
vote. The floor votes are controlled by the floor leaders, the majority leader and minority leader. Had the vote come up earlier, certainly I would have been there, wouldn't be able to do it. And I'm nicknamed a closer in the Senate of Pennsylvania because I am there on the floor all the time, and I'm usually the one who presides when the lieutenant governor has to leave to close out session. So it's a rare occasion that I wasn't there. And like I said, I don't let people vote me if I'm not there.
Let me read a comment here. Actually, a tweet from Katie says, can Mr. Rafferty elaborate on his plans to take on the heroin epidemic?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Great conversation. This is now a crisis. And it's a holistic approach, and realizing the short amount of time we have, I'll be concise as possible. There's heroin, but hanging right behind there is still meth and crystal meth and cocaine. So there's all these drugs that we're looking at. Problem in Pennsylvania is many states, we have all these silos where everybody has, this is my control, this is my control. So what we're looking to do is a multi-pronged task force. We'll have joint efforts with the DAs in each of the counties to disrupt and dismantle operations, disrupt and dismantle. And what that means is we'll use our joint resources for intel and for enforcement. The DAs, their sheriff's departments, the local police all have a better idea of what's happening on the street. They'd go after the street dealers. We'll go after the mid-level and high-level drug dealers. We have inter-county jurisdiction, which is helpful going after those individuals. And you continue to hit them. And knowing that the next day someone else is going to take their place as you travel through the state and hit other counties and you come back in and hit them again. So you're disrupting their cash flow and their business operation. That's how you're going to affect them. And then we have an educational aspect, Marty, where we were talking about going into the schools to teach the kids in junior high and high school. When I had one of my roundtables, a teacher said, you better start in third and fourth grade. Mm. So, and talking to other educators, they said they know about drugs and alcohol in third and fourth grade. So we're now gearing our program for that. And then lastly, the addicts, you can't jail your way out of the situation. And much like I did on the Veterans Court Steering Committee that I was appointed to by the Supreme Court, we're going to make sure that we have programs available to get those addicts who are nonviolent offenders the rehabilitation, the care they need to once again become productive members of society.
You mentioned heroin and meth. There is also the opiate problem, mm-hmm. which in many ways is seen as a bit of a gateway to heroin addiction. How do you address that?
We've been very active in the General Assembly, and I'm happy to say I've been one of the partners in that as a senator. We just recently enacted a number of significant pieces of legislation where the governor has lauded us for us, and he signed them, and we're continuing to work with the governor on additional ones. We have a platform that's now available that doctors have to use before prescribing drugs that they'll go on and find out if an individual is doctor shopping. And I happened to be in Pittsburgh, Marty, a couple weeks ago, where a family pharmacist came up to me and said, you know that bill you guys passed? It really works because someone came in and gave me a script for a painkiller. I punched him up and found out that he had gotten a 30-day supply just 10 days ago from someone else, so I was able to stop it. Additionally, we passed legislation which limits the amount of painkillers that doctors can write in emergency room situations because they're not knowledgeable really the full length of the person's injury. So, it's triage in emergency rooms is what I'm saying.
Sure.
They do a great job, but they're triage. And we also have now legislation that requires medical schools to train doctors on prescription writing the opioid addiction problem.
Marianne, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Jessica from Philadelphia has to say. And Jessica, go ahead. You are on the air. Go ahead, Jessica.
Hi, good morning. I was just wondering if you support the Pennsylvania Fairness Act, and if you do, that's wonderful, and if not, I was just wondering why you think it should be legal to discriminate against gay and lesbian Pennsylvanians in the workplace and housing.
And is that what the act is about, Jessica?
Yes.
About housing discrimination or addressing the problem of housing discrimination?
Yeah, that started to I'm sorry. Go on, Jessica. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's all. Yeah, it's about protecting gay and lesbian Pennsylvanians against discrimination.
Fair enough.
I don't think anybody should be discriminated against, regardless of religion, regardless of ethnicity. I don't think any Pennsylvania should be discriminated against, and I believe there's some laws there on the book. Now, I know there was the Fairness Act. I didn't realize what it was until she started to describe it. It was starting to move in the Senate, but it hasn't gotten out of committee at this point. So I won't be there to vote on. I'll be in the Attorney General's office, but certainly when the legislature passes, I will enforce as the Attorney General.
Do you support Donald Trump?
I am running for Attorney General. And since day one, I've been running for Attorney General. Part of my campaign has been I'm keeping politics out of the office of Attorney General. We had disaster for 3.5 years from a politically ambitious person with little experience, sounds familiar, who wanted to be Attorney General. From day one, before there was a Republican candidate, before there was a Democrat candidate for the presidency, I said, I'm running for Attorney General, keep politics out of the office of Attorney General. That's how I've run my campaign. I've been very clear, and when I've appeared for myself as Attorney General.
I'm seeing a quote here basically saying you're focusing on that, but according from the Pennsylvania Press Club. But I will tell you something. Donald Trump has shown me in the past couple of weeks positive signs. He picked Mike Pence, very good governor, legislative executive experience, will help in Washington, D.C. Is that as far as you're willing to go?
That was in June, I guess.
July.
Sorry. And there were some positive signs. Look, there's positive signs out there now. I mean, the polls are closing. I think somebody said there's a 1-point difference of even that, and let's face it, that's statistical dead heat. I can tell you one thing. I'm not going to vote for somebody who I believe has performed gross negligence in office and allowing a server to be hacked by foreign governments and sharing emails with foreign governments by not having a secure server, and has been part of a foundation that's done questionable practices. I will not vote for that person. I can tell you that for sure. But I have continued to be strictly focused on my kind of, unlike my opponent who's been at every Hillary office opening, I've continued to focus on John Rafferty for Attorney General, and I would have been that way no matter who was the presidential candidate for.
You said at a recent candidate debate, and I'm quoting here, recently, though, the media has reported on thousands of illegal voters here in the Commonwealth. Frankly, that's something that Donald Trump has said about the Commonwealth. There's been a lot of pushback on that. And I have to say, I looked at PolitiFact. They rated what you said there and the examples that you gave, and they gave you a pants on fire, which is their, I guess, lowest rating for when it comes to truthfulness. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Well, two things. Number one, I don't know who those people are, and I've got an opponent saying he's chairman of the Pennsylvania Commission on Crime. They didn't rate him. The Pennsylvania Crime Commission went out of business 25 years ago. 25 years ago. You can't say there's not speeding on the highway because tickets aren't given out. Yes, I do think that there's voter fraud, and I'm going to use a couple instances. Number one, we're seeing it today in Delaware County, Philadelphia County, where they're raiding offices of people that are illegally registering people. There's possibly criminal conspiracy. Another issue is one of the local TV stations, after that, some of that came out, went out and checked, I don't know, half a dozen people, 10 people within a day's time, and found out people that died in 2010 were still voting. Now, I know absentee ballots, but not that far. And then one other thing, there was an election in Philadelphia, which people like to forget about. There was an election in Philadelphia where a state Senate seat was filled, and a guy named Bruce Marks won that election.
And I should just say to our listeners, this was several decades ago, but nonetheless an important case.
Yeah. You think it stopped? At any rate, it was 1,000 votes. So there's your 1,000 votes, where Bruce Marks had won the seat, but all of a sudden they found absentee ballots somewhere, and the Board of Elections awarded the seat to his opponent. His opponent then went up to Harrisburg to be sworn in, and a federal judge had intervened throughout the absentee ballot and said Bruce Marks is the winner.
Well, and I should add that the Republican member of city commissioners, I'm probably saying that slightly incorrectly, said basically from his perspective, he's a Republican, which is that there are sometimes mistakes and things that are made, but in-person voter fraud, that's really what voter fraud is about in many ways, does not exists except for maybe a handful of cases in Philadelphia.
Al, I like Al a lot. And I didn't gear just to Philadelphia. I said, you know, voter fraud. And I do believe that there is voter fraud going on. I don't care what this fact check group said. The fact of the matter is we have state police and the attorney general raiding offices today in two counties and probably more where you have 10 and 14 people registered to vote the same address that aren't there. No, there's nonsense going on. And for anybody to say, oh, nothing's going on, I think we have to be ever vigilant, and we're going to be that when I'm Attorney General.
Let me just quote something. The current Attorney General, obviously Acting Attorney General Bruce Beamer, told the Philadelphia Inquirer editorial board, and this is about the raiding of these two offices, the probe focusing on canvassers, quote, caught cutting corners when it comes to registering individuals or doing stuff to meet a quota. And I guess registering is one thing. Voting, of course, is something else.
Yes. But registration gets you into the door to vote, Marty. So let's be very clear on that. You don't get in if you're not registered. And all I've ever said was we have to be ever vigilant on that, whether we use ID of any form. We have to protect the sanctity of the voting booth to make sure only those that have taken the time to register to vote are registering to vote. By the way, Bruce is the Attorney General. He's not acting. He's Attorney General.
He's Attorney General.
He was approved he was appointed by the governor, approved by the Senate.
You're absolutely right about that. Yeah. But what's interesting, and I don't want to relitigate the voter ID law or bill here in Pennsylvania, but when it came to essentially the Corbett administration showing if there were examples of in-person voter fraud, they didn't introduce one case. And obviously the judge ruled against voter ID in Pennsylvania.
Yeah. I wasn't part of the team that litigated the case. I do believe that, look, you need an ID to get your prescription, you need an ID to I need IDs to register for hotel rooms. I'm traveling to the Commonwealth. And all I've ever said was there should be some kind of identification to protect the sanctity of the voting panels, the voting place. And we've seen instances. People could say, oh, well, no. Well, there's one with 1,000 votes in Philadelphia in that state Senate election. So they're fact checkers as your 1,000 votes right there. Mm-hmm. And then there have been other instances now with what we're seeing. So
if you become Attorney General, would you want to bring back then a voter ID law?
That is strictly a legislative matter. The legislature is the one that passed that at the time the governor signed it. You can't bring it back as Attorney General. That would be a legislative function.
Let me see what Jose from Burlington County has to say. Jose, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to see if you can speak on the issue of judiciary reform. What kind of ideas do you have there, and do you find a need?
And this, I assume, has to do with the Pennsylvania Supreme Court?
Yes.
About judiciary reform, reform of the Supreme Court. Does it need reform?
Oh, okay, I got you. I'm sorry, Jose. I apologize. I didn't understand your question at first. I think that the court has already begun to reform itself ever since the leakage of the email information. You've seen two justices resign because of that. They paid the price for that. And I think that you're seeing now with the new justices that were just elected and Chief Justice Sayle, who I have a high regard for, and Justice Max Baer and Deborah Todd, they're working now to make reforms within that judicial branch. But as Attorney General, we're going to watch it to make sure that those reforms are put in place as well.
Jose, thanks for the call. Let me read a tweet from Jim. This is following up on our discussion about guns. He says, but what about the part of the law where cities are responsible for NRA legal fees? This is just wrong. Can you speak to that?
I'm not sure that was in the second bill. I know it was in the first bill. And that was to kind of be a deterrent for cities to go ahead and enact that legislation and have the state spend the money to go after them and say you can't do that. And that's why that was in there as a deterrent.
Where do you stand on the statute of limitations when it comes to child sex abuse?
Marty, I'm a staunch Catholic. And I was raised a Catholic. I'm still a Catholic. But I was the one senator that at the Senate Judiciary Committee took on the then acting attorney general who said that he thought it was illegal. And I did my thorough explanation that I did not think the remedies clause of our Constitution was barring this statute of limitations challenge. For this reason, the remedies clause was put into the state constitution in those instances where businesses or institutions were performing a particular practice that at that time was legal, was it legal and acceptable. And then later a legislature decided, well, now it's illegal and unacceptable. So it prevented people from going back saying, oh, wait a minute, you have to give us money because of that and the way we were operating within the law. But pedophilia was never legal in Pennsylvania, will never be legal in Pennsylvania, is not legal in the Bible. And I took grave issue with that. I favored the statute of limitations bill that came over from the House, recognizing that difference.
To lift it.
And I spoke out in Senate Judiciary Committee hearing and then the Senate Judiciary Committee meeting where the amendment was offered. I voted against it, as I did think three other members voted against it, because we wanted the original bill. But we came out to the floor. We tried to get back to the original bill. It was Senator Wagner, actually, who moved the prior printer number, and it failed. So with the amendment that was offered, we voted it 44-0, I think, to get it to the House, because what the amendment did increase the civil time, did increase the criminal penalties and the criminal time. I didn't want the status quo, which is unfortunately still what we have. I didn't want the status quo. I wanted to change. But I met with Representative Rossi, who's the prime sponsor of statute of limitations, and we had a press conference. And if they would have gotten it out of the House over to the Senate, I would have once again taken charge and tried to get the senators to see the wisdom in that piece of legislation.
If you're Attorney General, is there anything that you could do in that position to move this along, or is that really within the responsibility of the legislature?
Certainly you can lobby the legislature and work with the legislature, but it is their function. They have to do this. It's a constitutional change. It has to be the legislature that says – or it's a piece of legislation that they would have to enact and allow that to happen. Strictly theirs, and the governor would have to sign it.
An email from Beverly saying, Kathleen Kane clearly made serious mistakes, but for John Rafferty to deny that there's an old boys club in Pennsylvania, politics shows he's blind to the treatment of women. With the statement, I have no confidence he would be inclusive or have an understanding of another perspective. Can you respond to that?
Yeah, that's nonsense. Anybody and the legislature would tell you I'm the most inclusive person there, not a Democrat, Republican, conservative, liberal, and I would certainly be part and parcel of working with anyone in the legislature. I'm part and parcel over in the Office of Attorney General. If someone's rights are being denied, I'm going to go after them as Attorney General. I don't choose who the people are. I'm there to make sure everybody is equal before the bar of the court, and I will continue to do so. Kathleen's the one who kept saying it was the old boys network. And I'm not saying most of it wasn't males, but there were women involved in that too. And we can't say that they weren't part of perpetuating that system. But I will make sure the people's rights are protected.
You have taken a no politics pledge. Why and what does that mean?
For the Office of Attorney General?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I thought you meant for the Senate. I was going, well. Though in the Senate, I'm known as one of the most bipartisan people in the Senate of Pennsylvania. I've taken that no politics pledge because I believe it is vitally important for the Office of Attorney General that you don't look this as a rental space, because you're going to make decisions, even in the back of your mind, that I want to be governor or U.S. attorney, and so I'm going to make this decision to prosecute this or do this. I believe that you have to have someone from the attorney general's office who only wants to be the attorney general, chief law enforcement official, and a chief lawyer for the Commonwealth. Awesome responsibilities. And you have to make sure as attorney general that it's clear what your goal is, what your function is, and I think that's why it's vitally important to say, I'm not going to be governor. I'm not going to be U.S. senator. I want to be the chief law enforcement officer, the chief lawyer for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, do what's right.
Almost out of time here. There was one or two laws that the former attorney general would not defend. Are there any laws in the Commonwealth that if you are attorney general, you would not defend?
The duties are clear in the Commonwealth Attorneys Act. You defend the laws of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, those duly enacted by the legislature, those signed by the governor. You defend them. There is one branch of the government. See, the very wise people came up with our state constitution modeled after the federal constitution. There is a third branch of government. Those men and women wear black robes. And those men and women in the third branch, they determine the constitutionality and the unconstitutionality of the law. You can't do that. It's a dangerous precedent. Plus the fact – I'll give you use an example.
Bruce, well, you have 2 seconds.
Bruce Castor said it was unconstitutional. Bruce Bremer said it was constitutional. You can't have that in an attorney general. The courts make that decision.
John Rafferty, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times. And again, John Rafferty, the Republican candidate for Attorney General in Pennsylvania. After this very short break, we go out to North Dakota, talk to Jeff Brady about the pipeline protests. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. The protests in North Dakota over the Dakota Access Pipeline continue. Members of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and others want to stop construction of the oil pipeline because it could contaminate drinking water and harm sacred lands. Earlier this week, President Obama said the Army Corps of Engineers was looking for an alternate route away from the Sioux Reservation. The protests began last spring and have become a national, even international story. NPR's Jeff Brady has been covering the pipeline protests, and he joins us from Bismarck. And Jeff, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Jeff, what's the latest on the protests this week?
Well, last night there was a big protest, or a relatively big protest, at the state capitol right here in Bismarck. There were about 6 protesters, many of them clergy, and they were demonstrating their opposition to the Dakota Access Pipeline outside the Capitol building. A few of them actually went over to the governor's residence, which is on the Capitol grounds, and they knelt in the yard there, and there were officers all over. And, of course, the officers in this situation are always, heavily protected with, and sometimes wearing these face masks and looking a little menacing, or pretty menacing, actually. And the protesters were ordered to disperse. Apparently there are rules about where demonstrations can take place on the Capitol grounds. And some did, some did not. About 15 people were arrested. And, you know, for this whole series of protests, that brings the total number of arrests up to over 400 now.
Wow. And is it just local law enforcement, or are we also talking about National Guard and even departments from other states?
Right. I'm not aware of National Guard being involved, but certainly there are officers being brought in from other states. I'm staying in a hotel in Bismarck, and I went down for some coffee this morning and saw some of them were staying in the hotel where I am here. They're coming in from everywhere because this is this is not a populous place, and they needed more help than the sheriff's office has here right now.
Now, these protests began back in April. It was really just a couple of members, as I understand it, from the Sioux tribe or the Sioux Nation. Can you explain, Jeff,
sort of Rock Sioux tribe?
Exactly. Sort of how this whole protest movement grew and has become really an international story. Do you understand that, or do you understand how that happened?
Yeah, it just sort of built momentum over time. It did start with a very small protest right there in April when it was still cold outside, and then things started warming up and the weather started improving, and word got out all over the world, and people who've been involved in other civil rights movements in the past got interested, and people started coming here. I was here in September to report then, and was just shocked when I came over the hill and saw the protest camp. Just teepees and RVs and fires and kitchens and tents, just a huge field right along the Missouri River filled with protesters. And this time when I came back, I'd say there were probably fewer RVs, more teepees, not quite as many people, but still there are three camps of protesters here and a lot of people involved in this.
As I mentioned in the introduction, the protest is in many ways concerned about drinking water possibly being contaminated if there were some kind of a oil spill, or even harming sacred lands. Explain to us the thinking, Jeff, if you could.
Yeah, and I was talking with the chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe last night, because I've written many times in my stories that they're concerned about the pipeline crossing sacred land and potential harm to water. And I asked him to kind of put a little meat on the bones there. And this question of crossing sacred land it's just going to be really difficult to figure out how to square sort of how white America sort of administers, things like pipelines and square that with the places where these folks who've been here for a long time consider much of the land around here sacred because there are people buried there or there are stories associated with that place, and they consider those places alive, like they have a spirit. And so if you come in with a bulldozer and start putting a pipeline in there, they take that a lot more seriously than I think most of us would. And then the water issue, it's pretty much the same thing. There's a spiritual component to it as well. It's not just that there's a drinking water intake right there on the edge of the Missouri River, and if there's a spill from a pipeline, they're going to be the first affected. It's also that the water has a spiritual element to this tribe.
Does that mean that the pipeline is crossing through this reservation, or from the perspective of the Sioux, they really see that a lot of this land is sacred to them?
Yeah, it's not technically crossing through the reservation that the Standing Rock Sioux live on or have right now. But what it is crossing is what are called treaty lands. And these were lands that were given to the tribe in treaties in the past, and then the treaties were broken, and the property, much of it became private land. Now some of it is federal land. And but they don't really recognize that. They still see those as their lands because they were given to them in a treaty. And in general, they've been allowed to at least use them in spiritual ways that are important to them. They still feel that land is theirs. That pipeline is going to cross it now, so they feel like they should have more of a say in that.
And that's NPR's Jeff Brady joining us from Bismarck, North Dakota, talking about the protest over a pipeline up there. You've probably heard or read or seen reports of what's been going on. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. I see comments coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jeff, I also read that one of the original routes of the pipeline took it closer to Bismarck, and it was moved because there was fear that if there were some kind of a spill, that that could contaminate the water used by Bismarck. Is there something strange about the thinking that if they moved it away and there was a spill, it would affect other people down this pipeline route?
Yeah, and I've heard that talked about a lot. It seems like a pretty clear example of one group of people being favored over another. Now, I've gone back and looked through the environmental assessment that the Corps of Engineers has put together, and they talk about that earlier route and why this route was picked instead. And there are sort of hard, cold reasons why that is, like if they put it up there, it would require more miles of pipeline. Of course, more miles of pipeline is more risk of spills, more places where it could spill. It was also a lot more expensive. And so if you look at that environmental assessment, it kind of lays out very logically why this place was picked and not that place. But then you go talk to the tribal members and they say, yeah, that's what they always do. They come up with an argument that looks very, very logical, you know, that a judge would look at and say, oh, of course, that's the right thing to do. But they say, we know what's really going on here, and we're getting the short end of the stick. That's the tribe speaking.
And what was the local reaction when President Obama said earlier this week that he was going to ask the Army Corps to at least take a look at the possibility of another route? And we've been focusing largely on the Sioux tribe and their supporters, and I'm curious about the people on the other side. But what's been the reaction to President Obama's statement?
I would say surprise all the way around. And here's why. I mean, this pipeline is already under construction. And the part we're talking about here that's being protested over is a very small part of a nearly 1,200-mile-long pipeline where it crosses, is scheduled to cross underneath the Missouri River. And so... And now I've lost the question.
No, that's okay, Jeff. Don't worry about it. I at least remember the questionnaire, the response of President Obama's comments earlier this week.
Right. And people were very surprised. I'm sorry, I'm just rocking a few hours of sleep here.
I understand. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, so there was a lot of surprise because that construction is pretty much up to the Missouri River now. And so the idea of rerouting it, like, how is that going to happen? Even the tribe was surprised to hear that, pleasantly surprised. The company building the pipeline, Energy Transfer Partners, they were absolutely surprised. They put out a press release, or not a press release, I asked them for a statement, or I asked them for an interview, but I got a statement. And they said, we're not aware of any plans to reroute this pipeline. But then I heard back from the Corps of Engineers, and they said that we're kind of exploring all of our options. And the president, of course, gave us a little bit more detail on what some of those options are, but not a lot. It's going to be interesting to see where the Corps ends up on this, because just physically, it seems difficult to reroute this pipeline at this point.
The president also said about letting it play out. It's hard to know exactly what he meant by that. But obviously, because of all this attention, there's so much focus on what's going on there in North Dakota. Were there hearings, Jeff, and as this pipeline was being built, chances for protesters to object or at least have their objections known? I know there was at least a lawsuit.
Yeah, and there were a lot of hearings, and they took place kind of at different levels, the state level and the federal level. The state hearings were probably the longest process, and that's the one where you hear, well, the tribe didn't even participate in these things. You know, we let them know that they were happening, and they didn't show up. But this tribe doesn't trust the state of North Dakota and the people who run the state. And they also see themselves as an independent nation. I mean, they are technically an independent nation, and they want to deal with the federal government, not the state government. And so then there were the hearings for the federal government, and the tribe's concerns were that environmental assessment that I was mentioning earlier. Right. All their concerns are listed right there. So they were apparently taken into consideration, but not addressed to the to the tribe's satisfaction.
Let me read some email here. This is from Jenny. Jenny says, can you speak to the pepper spray and macing and other violent tactics being used against protesters? I've seen some very disturbing live videos. And I think if people are paying attention, you can see certainly online and news accounts that, at least on the face of it, Jeff, look a little disturbing.
Yeah, I've covered a lot of protests, and you can tell when local leaders are accustomed to covering protests because over time they learn that if you take a little lighter hand, people get to express their concerns and you don't have these violent clashes like we've been seeing here in North Dakota. Mm-hmm. Apparently here they haven't learned that lesson, and so we did see some pretty extraordinary things happening, and that just creates this tension that just gets ratcheted up, and we're still experiencing that now. Sometimes we'll have a protest and it'll kind of like calm for a couple of days, and then it just ratchets right back up. And I think part of that is because of how these officers appear and how the sheriff's office is responding. And I should say that the sheriff's office has been brought in at the invitation of the Corps of Engineers. And that has also upset a lot of people here because, again, you're talking about a state or a local government when this tribe wants to be dealing with the federal government. But it's local deputies who are local deputies and deputies from across the country who are there trying to keep them off these off this pipeline route.
And Jeff, I wonder if you've heard this. This is a comment from Richard who says, anyone who understands American history should be so ashamed of this pipeline construction. The Bundys get a slap on the wrist for taking over a wildlife preserve with weapons and rifles while Native Americans protecting their land, not protesting, protecting. Is that something you've heard in North Dakota?
Yeah, and I know that a lot of the protesters want to be called protectors, and that's fine. And I as a journalist, I can't really use that term because that's a term that comes with a judgment that's just not allowed by our editorial standards. But I understand that people want to be called protectors. Again, I forgot the question.
Well, that's okay. I mean, they're comparing what's happening in North Dakota to what happened with the Bundys.
Right, with the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge out in Oregon.
Right.
And yeah, I've heard that comparison a lot, and it is sort of a striking thing to think about that out there, they occupy the National Wildlife Refuge. The law enforcement there took a fairly light approach at first, and then, of course, one person did die in that incident. No one has died here, and then there was the court case where they were not found guilty, and so here we haven't had, you know, trials yet, but it is a lot of people are very interested in comparing those two things, and it is probably a lesson in our history.
We're almost out of time here. We haven't really talked about supporters, but I'm assuming there are people in North Dakota that favor the pipeline.
Oh, of course. I mean, this North Dakota has become an oil state. There's a trickles of oil coming out before. Now there's a flood, and that's mostly because of hydraulic fracturing. They've been able to tap into resources that just were off limits before. And so they need pipelines to get that stuff out of North Dakota into places where there's more population and they can sell it. And they've been doing that by train, which is relatively safe, I guess, but not as safe as pipelines. There are a lot more accidents involving trains than there are accidents involving pipelines. And plus, probably more important to the folks here, it's a lot cheaper to transport oil by pipelines. And so when you have a situation now where oil prices are really low, you want the cheapest way as possible to transport it.
Well, we know North Dakota winters are brutal. Jeff, we're almost out of time here, but what is, I guess, the next move, or what are you waiting for?
Yeah, well, you know, people here are already thinking about winter because it's getting cold at night. And when I talked with Chairman Archambault with the tribe yesterday, he said that's a big concern for them. And they're making plans for that. So when the cold weather comes, they're going to be able to keep protesters warm because they expect people to hang out all the way through winter.
Jeff Brady, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. NPR's Jeff Brady joining us from Bismarck, North Dakota. He's been covering the pipeline protests. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for the newsletter, listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us.